Judicial Correction Services. Is it Hood?
Yes, sir.
Yes. Okay, you can begin now.
May it please the court, Chris Hood for appellants, Linda Thurman and Courtney Carroll. And I know Ms. Thurman is with us today for the argument, as is my co-counsel, Anna Carroll. There are only two possibilities, factually, in this case, regarding the command to pay JCS a probation fee. We know Ms. Thurman got the command, as did Ms. Carroll.
Right.
Either it was issued by a private citizen, an employee of JCS, or it was issued by a municipal court judge.
Was it entered on the docket of the municipal court, the probation order?
The order itself is not in the electronic record produced by JCS from the city of Montgomery. There's an electronic record of the sentence, which is the fine and the court costs. And there's a notation of probation on that same record. But the order itself, the document that Ms. Thurman received.
Do they not have a document? So when a probation order is entered in a municipal action in Montgomery, is the probation order itself entered on the docket?
I don't have a docket. And the record doesn't have, there's no docket record, no docket, I'm sorry, in the record, Your Honor. We have the electronic record of this incident for each of the plaintiffs.
Mm-hmm.
And we have
the probation orders, which I notice the Alabama rules have, for some orders, requirements of judicial signatures. Probation orders have to be written. I don't see a provision that says they have to be signed. But one of the things I wondered is it entered on a docket? Does the municipal court have a docket?
Well, I know from outside this case that there'll be dockets. Municipal court judges will have dockets and their JAs.
But we don't have evidence one way or another about whether these probation orders were entered on the docket, is what you're telling me.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
And our evidence shows circumstantially, of those two possibilities, there's only one, that it was issued and given to the plaintiffs by the private employee, not the judge. And we know from JCS employee Hamby that when the judge was present when these commands were given out, that the judge signed the order, and since they're unsigned, it follows that the judge was not present. That's the first ground for the summary judgment granted to JCS, that the orders given to the plaintiffs are final state court judgments unreviewable by the trial court or this court under the Rooker-Feldman doctrine. But because they weren't given or issued by a judge or a court, we contend respectfully that they're not final orders of any kind and not subject to the Rooker-Feldman bar. Judge Pryor referred to Alabama Criminal Rule of Procedure 27.1, which does say that the terms of probation, including the command to pay JCS, has to be reduced to writing and an order.
Yeah.
Doesn't contain a signature requirement.
That's right.
But if you read that rule, the first condition, the threshold condition, the essential part, is that the court must have authority to issue the probation order in the first instance. And we know that wasn't true here. Neither Carroll or Thurman received a suspended sentence. And we know from our reply brief that the Judicial Commission of Alabama, when it disciplined Judge Hayes, said that these people were not eligible for probation. And it cites that rule.
The problem with that is we have to kind of litigate a question about Alabama law that would be litigated and could be litigated in an appeal from the municipal court's order.
It's true, Your Honor, but if you also
you'll know from the
record. That's the whole problem of Rooker-Feldman. The Rooker-Feldman is supposed to bar us from having that kind of relitigation of issues under state law that really could have been and should have been litigated as part of the state court proceeding.
And just to make sure I'm not conceding, what I was beginning to tell you was what the record reveals about the appellate process. JCS gave him a second document, it's undisputed, as did it gave all the folks in Montgomery that are situated like my plaintiffs, that said you can't contact the municipal court. They can't help you. It's a command. Do not contact the municipal court. They can't help you. Well, the notice of the appeal that you're referring to has to be filed where? The municipal court. So there's no access, which also disables Rooker-Feldman. But we don't even get to access and to disabling the doctrine unless you have a final state court judgment. We don't have that here. A private employee, we submit, can't issue a final state court judgment. A citizen, a private citizen, can't do that. A municipal court judge can do that, but there's no evidence that a judge did that in this case. The only evidence that I'm aware of from the briefing and from the citations to the record, both in the trial court and to this court, is a so-called window procedure, a printed order issued by Judge Hayes, who's now been defrocked, that said some people pleaded guilty to misdemeanor, traffic misdemeanors, may be placed, discretionary, with JCS. There's no reference to probation. There's no reference to a command to pay a fee to JCS. There's no reference to a fee.
Let me ask it this way. So I'm looking at the probation order for Courtney Carroll. It says at the top, in the municipal court of Montgomery, Alabama, right?
Yes, sir.
And it has a signature line for Montgomery Municipal Court. We'll say that's presumably for a judge, okay? Had that been signed by a judge, would it be your contention that Rooker-Feldman applies or doesn't?
It would be my contention that the signature, presence of the signature by a judge would turn us to that condition of Rule 27.1 of Alabama Rules of Criminal Procedure, which is whether or not it is an order in the first instance.
Right. Well, it says it's in the municipal court of Montgomery, Alabama. It says order of probation, now on this day by the virtue of the authority vested in me as a municipal court judge, pursuant to 12, 14, 13 of the Code of Alabama, I hereby order, and it then provides the order. What I'm asking is, if that's then signed by a judge, Rooker-Feldman applies?
No, sir, because of the condition of Alabama Rule 27.1, which says that only a misdemeanor, person convicted of a misdemeanor can be placed on probation if the judge...
That means that we would be in the business of litigating the state law validity of orders that have been entered by state judges, which that's precisely the sort of thing that Rooker-Feldman's supposed to prevent us from relitigating, isn't it?
I appreciate your point, Your Honor. You're saying if this is indeed a final state court judgment that could have been appealed, was not appealed,
right,
and that ultimately a late...
And, your problem with it is a state law problem that you contend makes it, in fact, illegal.
If signed.
It's signed by a judge. Correct. You could take that to, if necessary, the Supreme Court of Alabama for a ruling that this is a void order because it does not comply with Alabama law. Isn't that right?
If signed, that's correct. Everything you said is correct, Your Honor. And I'm sorry, I didn't mean to steer us away from the essential point, which I began with, is there's no evidence that the judge issued this order. This is a command issued to Ms. Carroll, Ms. Thurman, by...
So really what this comes down to is whether it has the proper signature or not. You're now conceding that if it had been signed by a judge, Rooker-Feldman would bar the action.
Because that fact would prove it was issued by a municipal court judge, Your Honor. We're talking about facts, circumstances. There's no evidence, no fact,
no circumstance which tells us.
I just wanted to make sure I understood the argument.
Our argument is based on the evidence. The evidence is there was no judge around to issue this command to our plaintiffs. The second ground for summary judgment was
the voluntary payment, right?
And I suppose I'll be better served reserving that for my rebuttal.
Well, you better say a little bit about it. I'll give you a minute to say something since I was interrogating you so that you don't, your opponent has something to respond to.
Three cases cited below, both by JCS and Judge Proctor, for involuntary payment, they're inapposite. They're distinct. Brown, Cruz, and Mount Airy. In the Brown case, there was no evidence of a misleading statement. Court goes out of its way to point that out, and it also says, apropos of our colloquy just now, that this was not an attempt to collaterally attack a conviction. As we've said in our briefing papers, we're not attacking the sentence, the fine, and the costs of the conviction itself. We're not attacking that. Those will not change whatsoever by a decision favorable to us in the trial court, assuming we get back to trial court. Cruz case, there was amnesty for the person who owed the ticket and who claimed that they shouldn't have to pay it. There was no threat of arrest, no duress. Duress, we know, in compulsion, improper pressure.
All right, so you're not questioning the payment of the fine and the cost?
We don't, Your Honor. We stand on that.
But the reason that there was that obligation to pay fines and costs was as a result of the order on probation that you say was not a judicial order because it wasn't signed by a judge.
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. The fine and costs were the result of going to the magistrate at the window and pleading guilty to the infraction, agreeing and signing the UTTC, the Uniform Traffic Citation.
Yeah, what your client signed, though, was an order of probation that purported to order the payment of fine/restitution and then checkmark payment of court cost, right?
And those obligations arose the moment they agreed at the window with the magistrate that they were guilty on the UTTC, and they could have paid that at that window and left. The only reason they had to go see JCS and get this command to pay JCS.
Is there an order other than the order of probation that purports to order them to pay fines and costs?
Well, the electronic record that I referred to at the outset.
And is that in the record? The
yes,
electronic record, where is it?
It is
in the record.
Well, it was exhibited by the defendant, so I may let Mr. Green tell you that, but it's certainly in there. It's certainly in our briefing papers, if I'm not mistaken. It's certainly in the papers we served.
Can I just follow on the voluntary payment? One of the requirements for that principle to apply is that the plaintiff paid in full knowledge of the facts. And I understood you mentioned the threat of arrest, but I understood your argument also went to your clients didn't. I mean, they thought they were following an order from a judge. They didn't. They didn't act with full knowledge when they made the payments. Is that? That's your argument.
That's correct, Judge Martin. We say that's another reason disables the application of the Brown case. They didn't know that they weren't being commanded by a judge. The statement itself is misleading, as is the second statement about not being able to contact a municipal court judge or get any relief from that court. These were all deceits practiced on Ms. Thurman and Ms. Carroll. And by the way, Judge Pryor, if I may return briefly, Judge Thurman's order, as exhibited by JCS and agreed upon in this case, does not have a sentence. There is no sentence at the top of that order. It's left blank.
Yeah, it is. That's true.
And thank you for that question, Judge Martin. And I'll reserve
that. Okay. You've reserved 5 minutes, Mr. Green.
May it please the court, obviously we've got two issues here, the Rooker-Feldman doctrine and the voluntary payment doctrine. The plaintiffs have got to go 2-for-2 to win this case, and they go 0-for-2.
On Rooker-Feldman, we know from the Exxon and the Target Media case that
It bars claims by state court losers complaining of injuries caused by a state court judgment rendered before the district court proceedings commenced and inviting review and rejection of those judgments. That's the test for
Mastock. He says this is not a state court judgment because it was never signed by a state court judge.
And we say, of course, it's an order under Alabama law. We've established that in our red brief on pages 14 through 16 for three reasons. Number one, the Montgomery Municipal Court said it's an order by virtue of its window procedure order document 9911. Secondly, Alabama law says it's an order because probation orders, as we've said in our red brief, don't have to be signed. They have to be in writing, which it is, and received by the probationer, which undisputedly occurred in this case. And third, and perhaps most importantly, the plaintiffs acknowledged that it was an order because they signed right below the language on the order of probation saying, I acknowledge receiving a copy of this order.
So they understand it to be an order.
So everybody involved understands it to be an order. Now, I submit you don't even have to look into the inside of the validity or invalidity of the order as an order, getting into sort of a metaphysical discussion of whether it's an order or not. We don't have to get into that because Rooker-Feldman doesn't allow us to get into that.
This court has said in Casal versus Tillman that
we do not recognize a void ab initio exception to the application of the Rooker-Feldman doctrine.
That's important because this court has twice in two unpublished decisions followed that, one being the case cited by Judge Proctor on his summary judgment order,
the Hirshhorn case, which specifically goes to the question of a void order. And the second one is kind of an interesting one. It's from a couple of months ago on a panel which Judge Martin was on, the Yeho versus Wells Fargo case. It doesn't specifically talk about this, but it applies Rooker-Feldman to a wrongful foreclosure claim where the allegation was there was a lack of standing on behalf of the lender. Well, if it's a standing error, it's a subject matter jurisdiction defect in the underlying state court proceeding. And yet the court says, we're not going to look into that. Rooker-Feldman bars that claim. So there's an instance which I think is a good textbook illustration of this. Judge Baldock has a recent case
from the Tenth Circuit, an unpublished case called
I'm going to be offended if you don't have one for me.
I think you need one, Judge
Which is an interesting concurrence, which I can get to. Judge Baldock's got a recent case from early this year.
I don't know if you want to go there. He doesn't think Rooker-Feldman's a thing.
The All Hog case where it was a pro se litigant, filed a Rule 60 motion, but specifically asked that a state court order be declared void. And one thing that I think will be helpful in sort of framing this is Judge Proctor frames the issue this way in his analysis. He says the real question here is there a void ab initio exception? Now, the plaintiffs have never taken exception to that framing of the issue, and I think that's significant.
Because our court, number one, in Casal, has specifically said in a published decision that we've never recognized that kind of an exception.
Number two, we've got two unpublished decisions that back that up. And really, to sort of crystallize the point, there's a recent Fifth Circuit case, a couple of years old, but I think it's illustrative for
a reason I'll get to in a second. The Fifth Circuit unpublished case is called Houston versus Vanetta Queen,
606 Fed Appendix 725. And this is what's significant about it. The language is, neither this court nor the Supreme Court has endorsed the void ab initio exception that the Houston brothers, the litigants in the case, advocate. And the cases do not recognize this exception. The cases that do recognize this exception indicate that it is presently limited to the bankruptcy context. Now, the reason for that is that in the bankruptcy context, we've got affirmative statutory grants of jurisdiction to
federal courts to block or countermand competing state
court rulings. That is not the case in the non-bankruptcy context. That's the reason, incidentally, in Casal versus Tillman, the published decision from our court from 2009, there's language that says this: other circuits have recognized an exception to the doctrine where the state court judgment is void ab initio, but our circuit has never adopted that exception. Now, the two cases cited by the panel in Casal are one a Seventh Circuit case
which doesn't really do anything but cite the Third Circuit case, which is the second case cited. The Third Circuit case is a bankruptcy case, and it is specifically getting into this exception, this for bankruptcy-type situations.
So the point of that is just to round this off. There is no authority,
as best I can tell, no authority for the proposition that there is a void ab initio exception at all outside the bankruptcy context. This circuit, though, has never recognized an exception, period, full stop. So,
can I don't know if you're ready to move on to another topic. I think you made your point well there. So I just have a kind of a record question. So it's my understanding that Ms. Thurman's guilty plea was never entered to the extent that there's a docket until after, you know, that she had paid all the probation fees. Is that right?
It's not clear.
From the record, we have located in the colloquy earlier with Judge Pryor, we have located in the record the electronic records that relate to Ms. Carroll. I don't have the complete record in front of me with regard to Ms. Thurman.
I think that's right. And so, you know, I've actually, you know, this is not the only case arising out of this situation that we have this week. And so we've all thought a lot about this. And I actually thought that, you know, Judge Proctor, you know, had a pretty thoughtful response to all the cases that he's seen. And in the Ray case, he seems to make a distinction based on the fact that there was never, I mean, that the judgment hadn't been entered. And so the Rooker-Feldman doctrine didn't kick in. I mean, why wouldn't that apply to Ms. Thurman, assuming that the guilty...
Well, the focus of the two cases is very different.
I know, but will you just follow it? I mean, so assume for me that Ms. Thurman's guilty plea had not been entered. Then under Judge Proctor's rationale in the Ray case, wouldn't that mean that the Rooker-Feldman doesn't come into play?
Well, I don't think so, because there would still be some remedial aspect or remedy available to that party via an appeal. But even there,
even though no judgment had been entered,
well, this it's different. I think from this perspective,
this litigant, just like Ms. Carroll, signed the order, understanding it to be an order. So, how are they going to appeal from an order they've agreed to?
It doesn't really make any sense. And so there are no cases that really address this question necessarily from the point Your Honor is making.
We get appeals in criminal cases where people have waived their appeal rights, and there are certain circumstances under which we have to consider those appeals. So.
Well, in this instance, we're simply dealing with the Rooker, from the standpoint of Rooker-Feldman, there's an order from which some relief could be taken. And even if we got past that, there's still the voluntary payment doctrine to deal with. This is someone who has signed a document agreeing to the terms of that probation, and under Alabama law, as Judge Proctor properly found, they voluntarily paid. And so
it doesn't really solve the problem.
Even if it were to solve a Rooker-Feldman problem, which I don't think it does, because she's, unlike most instances, signed it and agreed to it, she's still got to get past the voluntary payment doctrine, which she can't get past anyway.
Well, I mean, I've got my other thoughts about that. I just, you know, wanted your response on the Rooker-Feldman issue where the judgment had never been entered.
Well, I would say this. We're dealing
with folks who have agreed to a process and agreed to its efficacy as an order.
I thought the orders that were being attacked here, though, were the probation orders.
There's orders of probation. That's right.
And I thought we did have both Ms. Tillman's and Ms. Carroll's probation orders in the record.
The probation orders are in the record, yes.
That's right. I'm just saying her no judgment of guilt was entered in her case.
But she's not attacking that, is she?
No, and she's never contended that there was no valid judgment.
Well,
other than the lack of a judicial system.
Let me jump in here just a moment.
On a probation order.
Because yes. I'm confused. Because... There, they're saying that this was an individual action. As yes, I would say, they're saying that it's JCS and that that's not the municipal court. But nonetheless, we still have the probation orders that we're talking about. And me trying to simplify that down, for Rooker-Feldman, it would still require us to say that those probation orders were a nullity. And that's state action, which that's how I've simplified this. So if we're talking about the probation orders, then why isn't the end result that we're being asked to do as a federal court would be to nullify those probation orders?
Oh, that's exactly what the plaintiffs are asking for, and that is exactly what they've said in their second amended complaint.
And why is that not Rooker-Feldman?
It is.
It is.
Okay.
Absolutely.
I'm confused.
No, it is. The probation order.
That's exactly right. The probation order is what is being attacked here is the lack of a signature on the probation order.
Yes. Means that there is no legal basis under their theory
for JCS to be paid any probation fees. That's the theory of this case, and they make that quite clear in their second amended complaint. They say JCS was paid.
Tell me this. So the obligation to pay fines and costs, where did that come from?
Well, that's interesting because it's in the order of probation, too.
And they don't challenge that.
And that is a bit of discord
there in the theory, I think.
I was just trying to get you to address Judge Proctor's theory. You know, he says a claim challenging actions taken in the course of obtaining a judgment or order or in execution of the judgment or order can be distinct from challenging the judgment or the order. And well, you don't disagree with that.
I don't disagree, and let me explain that very quickly. In the Ray case, a lot of what's being alleged are actions taken in connection with the administration of probation into revocation proceedings and then post-revocation proceedings. And so the Rooker-Feldman theory as rejected by Judge Proctor, at least thus far, we're still battling that fight out in the district court in that case. But thus far, Judge Proctor has said, at least for motion to dismiss and ultimately motion for summary judgment purposes, those kinds of actions taking place following the entry of the order of probation through the administration process and revocation, that's not barred by Rooker-Feldman, which I think is actually consistent with the Target Media case from a few months ago, because they make that point of the sort of drawing the line of demarcation from the entry of the order and actions taken after that, whereas this is conduct. Really, their theory targets the entry of the order itself. They're saying this is not a valid order, therefore there's no basis for paying these fees.
And their argument for why it's not a valid order is all state law.
That's right. It's all under state law. Now, we can, as I said, we can peer into that question if we want to, but ultimately, I
would submit Rooker-Feldman doesn't allow us to peer into that question. In my remaining time, I do want to address voluntary payment very briefly. It's an independent ground for summary judgment. It is just as solid. Under Alabama law, is there a colorable legal demand? The plaintiffs never contested that at the trial court level. Judge Proctor made a point of noting that. Was the payment made with full knowledge of the facts? Sure. The facts are on the four corners of the order. The evidence is that
these people volunteered to go on this process by going to the clerk's window and pleading guilty. Is there any fraud or coercion?
No. Under Alabama law, even the threat to use legal process, which is what Judge Proctor found based on the Cruz versus City of Birmingham case, that's not enough to constitute coercion under Alabama law. And one point about Cruz I think that's very critical.
Mistake here. Your position is any mistake here is a mistake of law.
That's right. It's a mistake of law, not a mistake
of fact. To the extent that they thought that they had a legal obligation to follow this order of probation because, in spite of the fact that it hadn't been signed by a judge, in spite of the fact of whenever this kind of order ought to be available under Alabama law, those are all mistakes of law, not of fact.
That's right. If I could just take 10 seconds. One final point about Cruz. In Cruz, there was a threat of incarceration in the record. Now,
The payment was in the amnesty period, but there was a threat. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Green. Mr. Hood, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you, Judge. A couple of things. The electronic record for both Ms. Thurman and Ms. Carroll are in the record sequentially. I think you were asking about that. So
right.
That's not hard to find if they have the number.
Those are the orders we're talking about, right?
Just to be clear, Your Honor, there's two.
To the extent that they are valid, I mean, I understand your argument for purposes of Rooker-Feldman, these aren't judgments for purposes of Rooker-Feldman, right?
Well, there's two things in the record, just so the court's clear. There are the unsigned documents. We say they're unsigned. There's the actual document that purports to be the order which Judge Pryor read from.
Signed by your clients.
Correct, and given to them by the JCS employee.
But not signed by a judge.
And for which there's no evidence a judge issued them or approved them. There's just no evidence of that. The evidence is the other way, and I don't believe the other JCS disputes it. Then there is an electronic.
It is undisputed, though, that they were created and produced, administered pursuant to this standing order.
We disagreed with that, Your Honor. We said the standing order made no provision for terms of probation, a command to pay JCS, or it doesn't even use the word probation.
Okay.
Doesn't even use the word fees. There's no link. It also, that standing order is discretionary. It implies more than that. It says that it will be discretionary on the court. And there's no evidence that a court exercised discretion to order these plaintiffs to pay a fee to JCS. We did not claim in our brief, we didn't claim to Judge Proctor, because I was there for the argument, that we wanted these orders voided. We didn't use the words void ab initio. They're not in our briefing papers. They're not in our oral argument on summary judgment. It's true, when we pled this case 5 years ago, second amended complaint, February 2013, we referred to that, but we didn't have the evidence we have now, the evidence that developed, which is that these were never approved, issued, signed by a judge. We didn't have all of that. So we, as I said to Judge Proctor, we claim that we're not trying to undo anything. There's nothing done to undo. There's no order for us to undo. If the court's to affirm judgment on the basis of Rooker-Feldman, it's going to do so. It's going to be characterizing a document issued by a private citizen of Alabama as a final state court judgment. That's going to be the fact and the truth.
He's under a contract with the municipal court.
Under a contract with the city of Montgomery, Your Honor, not the municipal court, which is
to perform services for the municipal court.
True. And it also required that the payment would be conditioned on an order of the municipal court judge.
Further.
So, again, in the absence of an order by a judge, we don't see how the payment is anything but unjust and unjustly enriched JCS. As to involuntary payment, it's clear that Judge Proctor actually rested his decision on Mount Airy for good reason.
Until you look into the decision a little further, it's the most recent of the authorities. It's issued by the Alabama Supreme Court.
He references Cruz, but he ultimately rests it on Mount Airy because Mount Airy says that the threat of legal proceedings is not sufficient duress to render the payment involuntary. That's what Mount Airy says.
It cites to the CJS and cites to even older settled Alabama law.
But if you read the decision very carefully, what it's saying is the threat of being sued and the threat of going to court where you can vindicate the position you believe is the true one is not duress. I submit that the threat of an arrest is not the same thing. The threat of arrest is not vindication. Threat of arrest is the opposite of that. So we think that constitutes duress, and Mount Airy doesn't stand for anything opposite that. And so to the extent that the court used Mount Airy and to the extent JCS relies on it for their judgment, it's incorrect. It doesn't match up. Mount Airy in that regard favors the plaintiffs and not the defense. And I commend the court and recommend that the court take a careful look at that if it hadn't already. We've already distinguished Cruz and Brown also. And no further questions from the court.
Thank you. No, thank you, Mr. Hood.
Thank you.
Yeah. Keep going. Okay.
Okay, we'll go to the last case.